Well, watching all this closely from the other side of the world is Dr. Sheila Smith, an Asia specialist at the Council on Foreign Relations. She joined me from Washington. Dr. Smith, welcome back to The World Today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
So the two leaders are meeting alone this lunchtime. What are the risks and the benefits of a meeting with just these two and their translators?
So let's try the benefits first. It's obviously clear that President Trump prefers the personal relationship, right? Kim Jong-un is a new kind of, we're very focused on him as this new person who's stepped across the north-south boundary of the DMZ on the Korean Peninsula. He's not a leader who's been out and about in international society, in diplomacy very often. And so it might be useful for the two leaders to have a little bit of alone time, to sort of gauge each other, but also to establish a bit of rapport. The risks, of course, are, you know, what everybody has been talking about, is that whatever it is that's ahead of us on the Korean Peninsula, whatever this initial meeting is going to produce, there's a lot of heavy lifting to be had. If you want to denuclearize the North, there's a lot of technical expertise. There's a lot of very careful understanding of the history of our negotiations with the North. There's a lot riding on the line for the citizens of South Korea and Japan, our allies, the United States' allies. So there's a lot of concern and angst about what Donald Trump might say in the meeting and what might be promised or implied that might, you know, put at risk some of these larger issues about the long-term security of Northeast Asia.
How much trust do you think there's likely to be on either side?
I don't think we should expect much trust. Honestly, I think if you look just at the interests of the United States and the interests of the DPRK as expressed, right, to date by Kim Jong-un and by his father or his grandfather, we don't have similar interests at stake here. I think both countries want peace on the peninsula, but we wanted it different on different terms. And that's the real crux of this first meeting is, do we recognize that the DPRK wants legitimacy, wants nuclear weapons to make sure that its regime continues to survive? Do we recognize that they're really going to put all that on the table? And I think that that's where the weak spot is. I think when many of us look at President Trump, we're not quite sure what he's ready to bargain away. And I think this is a first step. I think it's a positive first step for all the hoopla and the drama. I'm actually a supporter of this meeting. But I think we have to be very careful to manage our expectations of what the outcome is going to be. There's a lot of hard work to come.
Well, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was pretty upfront today about the U.S. being duped before by North Korea. Mm-hmm. But he says that President Trump will not allow this to happen. How confident are you of that?
So I don't think that there's an awful lot of people who are surrounding the president, and whether it's Secretary of State Pompeo, who again was head of our CIA, he knows very well the technological progress on missile capability as well as on nuclear weapons that the North has made and how dangerous that is to us and to the region. You've also got John Bolton, National Security Advisor, who is quite a controversial figure, but knows this brief well. You know, he understands the problem well. He's got very specific views, but he's not ignorant of the complexities of what the president is trying to do. And then, of course, you've got Secretary of Defense Mattis, who is back here in Washington, who's been very clear about American interests and about allied interests in the region. So I think you've got a team that understands the problem and the complexity going forward. I don't think the president is not listening. On the other hand, I'm not quite sure where the president wants to take this conversation. So I think you've got some pros in our government, but you've also got the unpredictability factor, which is the leadership of Donald Trump.
And a wild card in this situation could be very dangerous.
Exactly. And we've all been watching him come out of the G7. He likes to disrupt. He likes the attention. He likes the drama. But this is not a place where that kind of play will be appreciated either by Americans or by our allies in the region.
The U.S. is still calling for complete denuclearization. But even if he wanted to go down this path, presumably there would be constraints on President Kim from his own military.
So I, you know, we know so little about the inner workings of the government of the DPRK. There is absolute power in some sense of the Kim family inside the country. Nonetheless, he has Kim Jong-un and his father before him have encouraged the military to create the kind of capability that we're now trying to negotiate away. So there will have to be some really strong incentives, I think, for Kim Jong-un to go back to the people he persuaded to move the country and to move technologically in this direction, to persuade them it's time to step back. Now, we can say it's economic incentives, but that's not enough, I think. We have to understand from him very clearly what it is that he is willing to barter with, what it is he wants in order for him to get to where we want him to be, which is this complete, irreversible, verifiable denuclearization. And that's the question mark for me. We don't know yet really what Kim Jong-un is really willing to do.
Is it possible that we could see a partial denuclearization deal done which protects the US from long-range nuclear missiles but does leave Japan and South Korea vulnerable to attack?
Yeah, well, there you have the conundrum for our allies. And I think there's been a lot of signals that the Trump administration may be willing to do that. And it may be that Kim Jong-un is coming into this conversation with the president thinking he can separate the United States from its allies. And that, I hope, the president is not going to allow him to do. I think what we must see, or we must recognize that we are going to see, is a phased process. No matter how serious he is about denuclearization, none of this happens overnight. So it is a step-by-step, it is a carefully negotiated transparency over what he has, which is both nuclear weapons and the missile capability to deliver them, and that will take some time. This is not going to happen again today or tomorrow or next week or the next month, and I think our allies are going to be very, very carefully scrutinizing what kind of synchronization the United States is willing to accept.
And if the United States does do a deal which disadvantages them, what is the likelihood that we could then see Japan and South Korea move out of the U.S. orbit?
So that's a big skip and a jump from tomorrow's meeting. But I do think what you'll remember that South Korea and Japan, A, are both non-nuclear powers, but they're also both democracies. And President Moon Jae-in of South Korea, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe of Japan, will have to make sure their publics are moving along with them as they watch President Trump and Kim Jong-un try to negotiate. This is going to be very tricky for both leaders, both Moon and Abe. They're going to have to persuade their publics to give the president a chance to negotiate with the North and not to jump to any conclusions about Japanese interests or Korean interests. That's a very hard task in any democracy. I don't think we're on the threshold of having the alliances fall apart, but I wouldn't underestimate the domestic politics that are also affecting the way in which this meeting is perceived.
China's leaders are also obviously watching this very closely. How much influence will they have in any final deal?
They will have a lot of influence. As you know, the economic leverage on North Korea to date has largely been Chinese. Their source of fuel, their ability to purchase, goods from North Korea. The Chinese have all the levers on the economic side. We don't have any. We could create some in the form of a carrot. We'll offer incentives, investment, trade, other kinds of things. But on the ground, we don't have any trade with North Korea. The Japanese cut off their trade more than a decade ago. And the South Koreans, President Moon Jae-in has closed the industrial park that had once been one of the pieces of the economic interconnectedness between the North and South. So China's got a lot of leverage. Whether China is willing to exercise that leverage remains to be seen. And what we can see is there's a certain amount of loosening of the sanctions. There is now air flights that are being allowed between China and North Korea. There's a little bit of softening on the Chinese side to help the negotiation process go forward. But again, trying to synchronize the interests of all of these parties and also provide North Korea with some incentives to move forward will be very difficult.
Well, China's and the United States' interests don't align necessarily either, do they?
No, they don't at all. And I think what we want is full and complete denuclearization. What the Chinese want is a little bit different. China has never, ever, ever said that North Korea should not have nuclear weapons. What China has reacted to is the provocations of the North, the escalation, the pattern of missile launches that we saw last year in 2017, all of those launches of short and medium range missiles, and then again the testing of that longer range intercontinental ballistic missile. The Chinese didn't like the North Koreans stirring the pot and creating the tension that they created in the region. But they've never ever said that that North Korea doesn't have the right to have nuclear weapons. The other place where I think China's long-term strategic interests differ from ours is I believe the Chinese still see benefits to their security in a divided Korean peninsula, so divided into north and south. I think gradually the United States has moved in the direction of seeing unification of the peninsula under the direction of Seoul, South Korea, as being much more in American interest. But we have, as you know, 28,000 men and women in uniform in South Korea. We have a deep stake in peace on the peninsula, whereas the Chinese have a slightly different view of what the long-term interests of the region may be.
And last time we spoke, you talked about the Russians also having a keen interest in North Korea, and you said that you feared the Russian leader may be preparing to play a spoiler role. What's your sense of Russia's position now?
So the interesting thing is that, as you know, Russia and the DPRK had a very close relationship during the Cold War. A lot of military equipment was given to the North by the Soviet Union. There was a lot of economic support given to the North Koreans by the Soviet Union. But when the Cold War ended, Russia was no longer in a position to do that. There's been a lot more recently, there's been a lot more commercial interaction between the Russians and the North Koreans. You still have North Koreans going into the Russian Far East as workers, remitting back, you know, capital, sending back money to the DPRK for their labor. So Russia has a deep economic interest with the North, but in the past attempt to negotiate with the North on the nuclear question, Russia has always taken a very firm line on nuclear weapons. They've been against it. They've been against the nuclear ambitions of Kim Jong-un and his father, Kim Jong-il. Today, that's a little bit more amorphous. The Russian position is slightly less clear, and there's some evidence, I think pretty substantial evidence, or pretty believable evidence, I think, that the Russians have undercut some of the sanctions activity. They've interceded, I think, with some of the oil and other kinds of goods that were being exported from the North. So the Russians are kind of on the back burner, but they're not disinterested. And so I think now you see a Russia that's much less constructive in terms of working with the Security Council or working with the United States on the denuclearization issue itself.
Just a final question, Dr. Smith. We had a former Obama Deputy Secretary of State for the region on our program yesterday, and he said that if this meeting fails, then Donald Trump may well abandon diplomacy of any kind for a military solution. Is that a concern that you share?
I think that's something that I worry about. We look at these summits we're looking at this summit as if it's the opening in a positive, constructive process. But high-level summits also fail. And to date, the Trump administration has moved in a direction of being very hardline on North Korea. And, you know, all the way up to thinking about perhaps even a preventive military strike against the North. If this fails, and again, failure can be defined in all kinds of ways. It can be muddling through, or the president made the comment the other day that if you walked in the room and thought Kim Jong-un wasn't serious, he'd leave. That this is a president who likes drama. We saw a little bit of that at the G7 meeting. I'm a little worried that there's so much at stake here for South Korea, for Japan, for China, for the United States, and obviously for North Korea, that a slight mishandling of the personal dynamics, right? Pushing the envelope a little bit on the drama, right? By our president or by Kim Jong-un, for that matter, could really leave us off kilter and make everybody step back to the distrust and the skepticism and the heightened military tension that we saw all the way through the end of last year. So I think there's all kinds of reasons to be worried about the fragility of this meeting. It could be the first step. in a larger process of negotiation. It could get us on the path to peace on the peninsula, all of which would be positive outcomes. But if it goes badly, it could also set us way far back. It could be very disruptive to the region, and it could leave us a little bit rattled and unsure of how we get back to a path of negotiation. So there's lots of reasons to worry.
Dr. Sheila Smith, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Dr. Sheila Smith, an Asia specialist at the Council on Foreign Relations.